All right, I'd like to welcome everyone to another episode of our weekly show, our Tax Town Hall. I do have, I believe, up on the screen the host, but you'll see that on the screen. But let's go ahead and say our prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Well, we're trying. We always try to have a great show for you, interactive show, which we like. Like to be able to talk to everybody and have them provide questions. You'll see that there's a chat feature. So we encourage you to chat. Liberally, that's the only thing liberal about the show, is to chat liberally. So we have tonight all four of your hosts, Attorney Larry Beecraft from Alabama. You can see on the screen there about how to get in touch with Larry. Sean O'Connor, you can go to seanoconnor.org or freeenterprisesocietyservices.org if you're a fast typer. And Gary Thomason, our co-host, he can be contacted directly by email, gary@npn.net. And then my website is agentfortruth.com. All right. Well, Larry's going to lead off, so go right ahead, Larry.
I am?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell our audience, a couple of days ago we discussed among the four of us what we were going to talk about tonight. And we picked this topic of dealing with the IRS's claim that certain arguments are frivolous. Now, there's a lot of arguments that are indeed frivolous that float around this movement. Now, if you want to find out some of the frivolous arguments, I've got them listed over on my website. Now, Joe has posted on the screen, you know, a way to get to my website. Now, I've got two websites. One's from a law office, which doesn't have legal information on it. Where I post legal information is a website that's on my internet service provider. And the way it's called the Dixieland Law Journal. That's that website. So to get to that website, you type in Beecraft Briefs or Dixieland Law Journal, and they'll carry you over there to this particular website. Now, down at the, you know, I've within the last year, I have cleaned, yeah, there it is. I've cleaned it up. You know, when I was building this, and over time, over 15 and 20 years, you know, it just got to be an uncontrollable mess. So I think last year, I kind of cleaned it up some. But down there at the bottom, Joe, go down to problems. And when you get over onto this other page dealing with problems, let me kind of explain things here. You know, favorite patriot issues. Over the years, I have encountered a number of just completely fabricated arguments. And there are gurus that will get out there and they'll be conducting their $200 weekend seminars for the gullible. And they'll be coming out with some new argument and they'll be trying to convince people to use it. Well, a lot of those arguments are under the topic of favorite patriot issues. Now, below the favorite patriot issues link, you'll see one called scams. Now, there's a lot of people, this lists some of the people like fake Judge David Wynn Miller. Wow, David Wynn Miller. Gary, have you encountered David Wynn Miller?
No.
You know,
I've avoided him like the plague.
Yeah, you can only speak in the present. He's got this funky way of this language. And it really is just lunatic. But, you know, let me show David Wynn Miller. Hey, Joe, click on that link and let's see if his website's still up. Okay, go to his website. There. Now, look, is that not insane? You got to speak only in the presence, you know? And so he's come up with this new way of speaking, and he has convinced a whole lot of people, or he did in the past, until people began to understand that he was really just another flake. But, you know, if you can understand anything about what he's read there, you know, it's written there, it's nonsense. But that's David Wynn Miller. But there are other people like him. So I address on the scams page. Go back, Joe. Go back one more time. These are various people that have engaged in what I call scams, you know, that I have encountered, not all of them, but some that I've encountered during my career, my association with this freedom movement. And, you know, they're just like Dr. Sam Kennedy years ago, you know, maybe back in 2006, 2007, 2008, he was getting people to file these claims for refunds, get money out of the IRS using this 1099-OID income tax return that was Roger Elvick invented and was promoted by Winston Shrout. And incidentally, Winston Shrout was tried a couple of years ago and convicted on a whole bunch of counts. And then he went, had sentencing earlier this year back in January, and then he had got sentenced to about 10 years in jail, which for him would be a death sentence. So he just ran. So he's up on appeal, but he's on the run. And, this is the type of nonsense that goes on inside the freedom movement. It's this type of nonsense that gets us, it earns us a bad name. Now, having said all this, you know, I just want people to become aware of, you know, some of the scam artists that I think I've been able to identify during my time in the movement. Hey, Joe, go back one more. Okay, favorite patriot issues. Hit favorite patriot issue. Now, you know, this is where I just address some of the issues that have been promoted inside the freedom movement. And I discuss them here. And they're just in no particular order. You know, like that new TD, that's a Roger Elvick argument, Treasury Direct Account. Wow, that's crazy. You know, invisible contracts, you know, admiralty, the UCC argument, names and caps. You know, there's a wide variety of arguments that I address on this page. But, you know, I just wanted to inform our viewers, our participants in this program tonight, that, yes, there are indeed some crazy arguments that get promoted inside the movement. However, there are also some very substantive issues. You know, I consider... Hey, the money issue is one of my favorite. I think the money issue is we're dead right. You know, Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the United States Constitution, no state should make anything other than gold, silver, coin, or tender payment of debts. At the time of the Constitution, the states had the power to declare legal tender. The states were disabled from making anything but gold, silver, coin, or tender payment of debts and pursuant to the prescription in Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the Constitution. And then Congress was empowered to fund the money. But over time, if you click on in reference to the money issue, there's a real good legal explanation about what's happened in reference to the money issue. It's, you know, Joe's got his cursor. If you go up a little bit, it says Monetary Powers of the United States Constitution. You don't have to open it. But that's a real good explanation of, you know, the legal history of the money issue in this country. But, you know, what's happened with the money issue is, number one, judges are afraid take on the credit mechanism in this country, even though it's ripping the people off. Number two, a lot of people don't know anything about this issue. Number three, you know, even if they do, you know, the judges are kind of real fearful, and I mean, they may be right. You know, sometimes when you take on the system, you know, when you know, if you were to say the Federal Reserve is, there's something wrong with it, you might end up dead. You know, that might be one of the problems with a failure of the judiciary here in America to address the money issue. But the money issue is something that's great. But, you know, we have a lot of good issues and we got bad issues. And I think what the people that are interested in the freedom movement, they need to be able to make a distinction between good issues and bad issues. Now, when it gets around to raising issues with the government, you know, the IRS has come along and they have taken some of these issues that have been promoted and run them in the ground. They say that they're crackpot arguments. There's no basis for them. Well, there's a lot of arguments that there is a very solid ground for raising the issues. And that's one of the things we're going to be talking about during tonight's presentation. And one of the things that Joe click on constitutional and other legal materials. Now down here, go down the page some, it's toward the bottom. Okay, yeah, okay. You see that link there, delegated authority brief in cases regarding delegated authority. Yeah, you click on either one of them. Now here you got, you know, I provide summaries of cases dealing with delegated authority and links so that you can, anything you see on my website that's got that blue, you know, the blue lettering, that is the link. So if you wanted to read the case of United States against Lee, you would click on the blue down there at the bottom and you would have access to the case as it's posted on the internet. You know, what's real important about delegated authority, yes, Joe, that's United States against Lee. And incidentally, that deals with, you know,
Robert E.
D.C. taking Robert E. Lee's house during the Civil War and burying, you know, his house overlooked the Potomac. And gee, we got a national cemetery there today. And where did that land come from? It came from Robert E. Lee. The United States took it. But Joe, you can go back. You know, years ago, you know, I was very interested in the issue of delegated authority. And so, you know, the cases that you see here, I created this. This is the way I do legal research. You know, I find the cases and I provide a summary so that, you know, my little summary of cases, you know, when I want to brief the issue, it's already done. I've got everything I need. So this right here is just nothing more besides the links. You know, if you got rid of the links, that would be the way it would look like on my computer when I was, you know, compiling the cases on dealing with delegated authority. Now, what's real important about delegated authority is that it's real important. You know, when you're getting around to this field of study regarding the IRS, you know, one big problem that the IRS has is delegated authority. Now, the Administrative Procedures Act, which Congress adopted in 1946, required certain things to be published in the Federal Register. In 1935, Congress came out with the Federal Register Act, which was basically the creation of a newspaper, a daily newspaper for the federal government. And this daily newspaper is the place where agency materials must first be published. You know, the law will define what those agency materials are, like regulations. You know, so after we got the Federal Register created and it was in operation in March of 1936, in 1945, Congress comes along and they're wanting to pass the Administrative Procedures Act, which gets passed in 1946. The Administrative Procedures Act is real important because, you know, from that time all the way up until today, the federal agencies were required to at least, you know, they started off talking about publish all your delegation orders, but, you know, but still today they got to publish their channeling of their functions. Now, when you sit down and you deal with the IRS, you know, I've done things like gone back and started back, you know, at the very beginning. You know, the IRS has been created. It's headed by a Commissioner of Internal Revenue. However, the Commissioner of Internal Revenue doesn't have any statutory authority in the law. The guy that has the authority to administer the tax laws is the Secretary of the Treasury. So the Commissioner of Internal Revenue, he operates pursuant to a delegation of authority. And there has to be delegations of authority from the Secretary of the Treasury all the way down to the, you know, the lowest man on the totem pole. And those items are required to be published in the Federal Register. Now, I've studied this issue for a long time. And the IRS at one time was busy, you know, quite frequently publishing its delegation orders. But starting about 1990, the delegation orders started vanishing. You know, the IRS was not complying. Now, here's one of the problems that crops up. You know, we have two problems in reference to finding out what is the authority for anybody that works for the IRS. You know, you're entitled, you know, there's Supreme Court cases. You know, the Supreme Court says, you know, you're entitled to know. You're charged with the responsibility of knowing. the authority of any agent with whom you're working at the federal level. Well, when you try to find out what the authority of IRS agents is, it's kind of hard. And then also you got this command that at least the channeling of the functions are required to be published in the Federal Register. So with this background in mind, you know, and with taking into consideration this brief, or this is not a brief, it's really there. Hey, Joe, go back. And there is a brief on this point. From this list of cases, see the delegated authority brief? And here you got a brief. This says, you know, what we, what the courts, it notes and summarizes what the position of the courts are, what they have to say about this issue of delegated authority. An agent of the government, an employee of the government, better have some delegated authority to do something. He has no authority on his own to do anything. There's got to be a delegation of authority. So what, over the years, you know, this issue, back in the early 90s, it was hot. And people went charging to court. You know, people were digging into delegation of authorities, you know, and challenging the IRS on it. But the IRS says, oh, gee, you know, in the their publication, about frivolous arguments. This is one of the arguments that they say, no, you know, people have been raising this for a long time. You know, the courts reject it. Well, the problem with the, for the IRS when they came out and say, you know, this delegation of authority issue is meaningless. It has no substance. You know, the problem is the IRS is trying to pull the wool over your eyes because you've got tons and tons and tons of cases. All of the circuits have addressed, you know, a wide variety of issues regarding delegations of authority, and it's crystal clear. Agents have got to have some delegated authority. The people that work for the government have got to have delegated authority to do something. And when the students of the income tax sit down and they start just trying to find out, to assume their civic duty of knowing the authority of the people with whom they're working inside the IRS, what is their authority? We are supposed to be able to check that out. It's our obligation to know their authority. But in trying to find that authority out, especially in light of the command of the Administrative Procedures Act that the channeling of the functions of the agencies is required to be published in the Federal Register, the IRS doesn't do that. So you got to wonder, you know, in reference to this, just one specific issue of delegated authority, there's tons of cases on the point. You can either read this this brief right here on the screen, and then you can go over and read some of the cases that deal with this issue. You can see that it is a clear point of law. Government agents have to have delegated authority. That delegated authority is supposed to appear at least in some way inside the Federal Register and also codified by the IRS in the Title 26 Code of Federal Regulations. And at one time, that was being done. From 1946 all the way up to 1948, the IRS was complying with the Administrative Procedures Act. But then in 1948, the IRS and the Treasury Department come along and said, oops, we made a mistake here. You know, this Part 601... or Part 600, where we were publishing the structure of the agency and the delegation orders. Oh, we made a mistake there. And so they quit publishing it. And since 1990, you know, you can't find anything about what's going on inside the IRS, about who does what. Who at the zoo has the authority to do what? So this is a real important issue. This is an issue that the IRS doesn't like. And since the IRS doesn't like it, they will say in their, you know, publications, oh, this issue of delegated authority is meaningless. No, it just means that they don't want it. They want to, they're doing the same thing that the Democrats are doing right now. The Democrats are going to come out with whatever, with any position that supports them, they're just going to loudly proclaim it, even if it's wrong. That's what the IRS does. It acts just like the Democrat Party. So I just simply want to, in my segment of tonight's program, I just wanted to make this one point. There's a wealth of law dealing with
the need for government agents to have, government employees to have delegated authority. Tons of cases on the point. There's even, pursuant to the Administrative Procedures Act, a requirement that, you know, some spot in Title 26 Code of Federal Regulations, you know, the IRS has got to tell you about their structure of the agency and the channeling of their functions, but it isn't there. And then the IRS wants to come along. If you raise this issue, oh no, you know, there's no substance to any of this. They're just trying to get you to drop and walk away from a good issue. But I do want to encourage people that, you know, when you start raising these issues, if you're going pro se, don't just, you know, raise an issue without investigating it. If you don't investigate it, study it, learn it, know it, then you're not going to be doing yourself a favor or the other people in this movement. So that's all I have to say on this issue right now. Somebody else want to pick up and talk about their issue?
All right, Larry, thank you. I think, was Gary supposed to go next? Or Sean?
Yeah. Well, Gary's, he walked away. Oh, there he is. Now he hears us talking about him.
refilling my coffee cup.
All right, yeah. Gary, go ahead and hit it.
Well, Larry, he was giving you some legal background and case law that you can use to question the IRS and other government agencies. What I'd like to turn our attention to is the title-wide definitions of what Congress intended for words to mean in this crazy area of federal law. And what I'd like to focus on is introduce you to 7701 definitions. And instead of just going right to a definition like A1 is person, you can see that right there on the screen. I would like for everybody to read that. That's subsection A, which says, when used in this title, they're talking about Title 26, the entire Internal Revenue Code. And this is where they, you know, this is where Congress lots of times will say, hey, we're not going to lie to you, but you better listen very carefully. And what they're saying is, we're not otherwise distinctly expressed or manifestly incompatible with the intent thereof. So whenever a word is defined in this title-wide definition, it is good for the entire title, unless there's another section of the code that has a specific definition that would be manifestly incompatible with the intent of the definition in the title-wide definitions. And in a few moments, I'll be giving you an example of that. But I'd like to focus on a couple of specific definitions. The very, very first one is person. When the IRS makes a reference to a citizen, they refer to a citizen as a person. And if you don't know any better, you're going to say, okay, well, I'm going to go look up the definition of a person. And then, you know, a person shall be construed to mean and include an individual. Well, I'm an individual, I guess, so I'm a person. And at first blush, you may say, well, that makes sense. That's common everyday language. But for federal income tax purposes, person is an artificial entity. An individual is the only living being in that definition. So with person somewhat remaining in our mind, Joe, let's go to A30. A30 is a United States person. So I would pose the question, is a person the same thing as a United States person? And since there's two separate definitions, I think the answer would be obvious. But a United States person means citizen or resident of the United States, giving each word its intended meaning, a citizen of the United States, as well as a resident of the United States, is deemed to be a United States person. Now, you don't see the word individual, and you know we refer to it as a word of art, but you don't see the word individual anywhere in that definition, do you? So these definitions are to be used throughout the entire Internal Revenue Code. Now, Joe, let's jump over and pull up section 911 to kind of show some contrast, and go down to subsection little d. It'll be the definitions. D is in dog.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, this definition is, I'd like to focus on two distinct points. The first one is obvious. It says definitions and special rules. And then that little phrase, for purposes of this section. So this definition, for purposes of this section, supersedes any definition that's going to be found in the Title I definitions referring to individuals or qualified individuals or persons. So the very first definition, it says, qualified individual. Qualified individual means an individual whose tax home is in a foreign country and who is, and it has capital A and capital B, so you have paragraph A and paragraph B. Paragraph A is a citizen of the United States. You notice it does not say citizen or resident of the United States. It says citizen of the United States, and establishes to the satisfaction of the Secretary that he's been a bona fide resident of a foreign country or countries, plural, for an uninterrupted period of time, which includes the entire taxable year. Now, if we were to jump back over to the Title I definitions, taxable year is even defined in the Title I definition. But we don't really need to do that, but we said we can. I think it's 23. Okay, so paragraph 23, taxable year. The term taxable year means calendar year or fiscal year ending during such calendar year upon the basis on which the taxable income is computed under subtitle A. Taxable year means in the case of a return made for a fractional part of the year under the provisions of subtitle A or under regulations prescribed by the Secretary, the period for which such return is made. Subtitle A, taxable year. Subtitle A is the income tax. So let's jump back over to 9/11, Joe. So we're looking at this definition of a qualified individual. A qualified individual is a citizen of the United States in paragraph A. And then paragraph B, it says a citizen or resident of the United States, who during any period of 12 consecutive months is president of a foreign country or countries for at least 330 full days. So if you're outside the United States performing services in a foreign country or countries, England and Germany, for example, you would be defined and described as a qualified individual. Now, while we're on this phraseology, under the definitions and special rules for Section 9-11, which would be citizens and residents of the United States abroad, we look at this definition, and I'd like to just focus in on what they're saying in this definition. The term qualified individual means, number one, an individual whose tax home's in a foreign country. So you got the identification of an individual, but they're calling a citizen an individual at this point because his tax home's in a foreign country, and who is a citizen of the United States. B is a citizen or resident of the United States. And so let's keep that in mind. And do we have 1.1-1A?